There are things you can do for people to feel that you are more confident, that you are more engaged, more passionate, more intelligent, all of those kinds of things.
Welcome to Your Intended Message, the perfect place for leaders and promising professionals who want to convey the intended message for greater success. Every week, we interview experts who address the challenges and best practices to deliver your message effectively. That might be one-to-one, one-to-few, or one-to-many. And perhaps the most important conversation, one-to-self. I'm your host, George Torok. My guest today is Melinda Marcus. Here's three facts that I think you should know about her. One, as a consultant, Melinda has helped executives open doors and close multimillion dollar deals by showing them how to leverage body language and persuasive psychology strategies. Two, she is one of only five people in the world to earn her master certification in body language from Joe Navarro, the former special agent who trained the FBI. And three, don't tell her tennis opponents this one. She wins a lot of tennis games because she can anticipate the other player's next moves by reading their body language. Melinda Marcus, welcome to Your Intended Message.
Thanks, George. It's so great to be here.
Delighted to be talking with you today. And as people might guess, we're going to be talking about body language, the power of it, the myths, and maybe we'll gain a few secret tips to beat you at tennis.
Of course, I'm willing to share.
What are one or two of some of the misconceptions when it comes to body language? What's more of the common misconceptions that people have that you correct for them?
Okay. Well, one of them you just gave an example of is a lot of times people feel like it's not a good thing to show your hands when you're talking and to have that be movement that might be distracting. Actually, in every research study they've done, that's with looking at people who are speakers, who are lecturers, professors, people who are witnesses on the witness stand. If somebody is stiff like this and they're saying things and not moving, people don't trust it. They feel you're much more of an expert, of somebody who's engaged, who's professional, who's passionate about what they're talking about, is if you naturally use your hands as you speak. You do that naturally. I do that naturally. But many times I've even heard people who were practicing for debate teams or public speaking, and they were given the information that they should have their hands at their side. Absolutely the worst thing you could do.
Let your hands move naturally, because if you freeze them, you look like you're hiding something?
Well, you used the key word there. You said freeze. When people are frightened or feel threatened, they have two modes that people think about, fight or flight. They forget that there's a third one. It's freeze. So think about what happens a lot of times with a deer in a headlight, right? That expression, it's freeze. Well, people freeze too when they're scared. So when they see you like this, something in their unconscious triggers. For some reason, that person is feeling frightened, threatened, or lack of confidence. So then they start thinking, I wonder if they're telling the truth or they don't feel good about what they're saying. So all those things are happening in a split second of the impression. Whereas naturally, when we really mean what we say, we're going to illustrate our points and emphasize our points by using our hands.
I think I heard there that just because they freeze doesn't necessarily mean that they are lying. However, it can easily be interpreted that way.
Yeah. So there's a lot of myths about nonverbals that indicate someone's lying. One of them is that piece of, if someone's just frozen, that type of thing. But you've probably heard the one that if you ask me a question and all of a sudden my eyes go up to the right and then I answer, that's a lie. That's been disproven. That got started in the 1950s. It was written, I think, in an MPL type of thing. There have been so many studies on that that show it does not matter where the eyes go, whether they go to the right, whether they go to the left. Neither of those things mean anything in terms of that somebody is lying. And when they've not only studied it in university settings with quantitative research, they've also looked at videos on TV. When you see somebody who comes on, oh, please help me find my children, they're missing. And then it turns out that person actually had killed their children, right? Well, they look at all those videos ahead of time and they see there's no difference on when people are lying or when they're telling the truth on whether the eyes are shifting. So that's another one that is absolutely not true. In fact, nothing, including electronics like a polygraph, are 100% accurate on detecting lies. What is more accurate is when you combine verbal and nonverbal communication to get at what is really going on here. And sometimes it's less about a lie where somebody is saying something wrong, but maybe it's a lie of omission where they're covering. Maybe they know guilt of somebody who's a friend of theirs and they don't want to rat them out. So it may be guilty knowledge or withholding of information, but you can find what the CIA and what the FBI call hot spots, meaning we see stress points, and you ask questions, open-ended questions about those things, and that's where you get revealed a lot of times the leads that lead to what's really going on.
Hot spots meaning a controversial question or a question that's going to stimulate them emotionally?
Actually, hot spots is referring to when I see stress signals every time I ask you a question, that is a hot spot for you. Okay. So I may just say something like, where'd you go to lunch today? And if for some reason you didn't want me to know about that, you may answer, but you may not tell me the truth or you may dodge it, but you will probably show some stress signal with it. So once, you know, I'll give you an example of a stress signal. One thing may be if you were asked me the same question, where'd you go to lunch today and who were you with or something? And I went, oh, you know, I just went to a place locally around town. It was nothing. I mean, it's like a hamburger joint. The hand coming up to the neck, that tends to be a very clear sign of stress. Now, it doesn't mean a lie. It means I have stress around that topic. And the reason we do that is the neck is a very vulnerable part of the body. And our hand being there protects it. But also, did you notice I started rubbing it? Okay. We have something called the vagus nerve that goes down here. And if you massage that, it actually lowers your blood pressure and your pulse rate. So it will calm you. So when I see people, when I ask them a question going here, I know there's a little stress around that.
So that's a self-soothing move.
Correct. And if you see it as a repetitive thing, we even call it self-pacifying is the term we use. Now, I will tell you, when I coach high-level executives, which I do all the time before they have an important presentation, a speech, they're going to be on television in an interview, I coach them that privately when you're in like the green room beforehand or whatever. If you're feeling that adrenaline rush and you're feeling nervous, go ahead and just do this, it will help calm you. And so it's something you can use as a tool. Again, you don't want to do that in public, but you know, privately, it's a tool to help you calm yourself down before you do something that's very important that you're feeling stress around.
That's interesting. So there's a move that one can do in private, but not in public. It makes you feel good, but you don't want to be seen to be making yourself feel good.
Correct. Or to be seen as what's, you know, even on an unconscious level, some people will pick that up as that person's under stress. The other thing that I advise, just to make sure I didn't have just an itch on my neck or something, what I advise is you go to another topic, see if my hand comes down, and then go back, circle back to the topic that it caused me stretch and see if that hand comes back up. And if it really is the topic, you'll see that the hand will come up or some other stress signal will start coming out when you mention a topic that is, for whatever reason, a hot spot for them.
So a test of a stressful topic is to talk about it, go away, and come back later and look for a stress signal.
You got it, George. That's exactly it. That's a great summary.
And while we're talking about touching the neck, what about men who often rub their chin, or especially if they're on a Zoom call, they rest their hand on their chin? Okay. What's that saying?
So let's talk about that. This is a subtlety, but most of us can see the difference. If I'm here, where's my weight of my head? It's on my neck, right? It's not on my hand. But watch this.
You slump. Yeah.
Now, the weight of my head is on my hand. So as long as somebody's here or here, that's interest, that's consideration, that's pondering, that's, you know, those kinds of things. As soon as that head moves the weight to the hand, that means I'm zoning out. So what I would advise to people is that they wrap up what they're saying. So finish that sentence and then ask a question to the person. So do you re-engage them? Right. And so what I would do is, if I was giving you a long sentence about some topic and I see you go from here to here, I'm going to finish my sentence. And I'm going to go, George, before I go on, we've covered a few different things. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts on that. Or did anything catch your interest there?
So now you're re-engaging them.
And I open-ended, not a yes, no. Right. Open-ended question.
Because that the transferring the weight of their head onto their hand suggests that they're not listening anymore. And so now you say something to bring them back into the conversation.
Absolutely. And if you keep talking, which a lot of people ignore it and just keep talking, all you're doing is talking to yourself because they've already stopped listening to you. So you might as well stop, get their thoughts, get them re-engaged. Otherwise, you're not really having any influence. All you're doing is spilling out words and nothing's happening. So generally, when I'm working with business executives or even medical professionals, we're looking at how can we make sure, A, we're connecting and really two-way communications, but B, often it has to do with influencing decisions. So to do that, you need to have the person be engaged. And you need to know if they have an objection or buy-in either, what's going on their side of it.
Speaking on Zoom, we can't see the lower body. We occasionally can see the hands. We're mainly focused on the head and shoulders, I suppose. What tips do you give to people to look more alert, more attentive on Zoom?
Yeah. So as you know, I've written a whole book on this actual topic. So it's called Read the Zoom, if anybody's interested in that. But I do want to say that while Zoom has this view of us, think about the view you have across a conference room table, a desk, or a restaurant table where a lot of business conversations and certainly relationship building are going on, right? It's the same view. So a lot of what we see here is whether we're in person or on Zoom, it's the same. The advantage to Zoom is that we can be closer to the person in Zoom than we would be if we were sitting in a conference room or something like that without being in their face. So we can see things we might not see in a live meeting. The disadvantage is often it's a little harder to read the kind of energy in the room and all those things that most of us can do when we're in a room with somebody. We kind of sense attitude and a lot of things like that. Whereas on a Zoom meeting, for a lot of people, that's harder. So when you're doing that, there's a lot of body language here. There's face, head, hands. We see more hands than you think, because the hands, especially you mentioned about a man who's doing this with the beard, and we see it with even I find myself sometimes here, right? And those self-touches is what we call them. Those tend to be showing a little bit of discomfort, not a lot, but when you start seeing FaceTime, and especially like a beard thing, when it's a lot, that is what we would call something that is really a self-pacifying thing. It's repetitive to calm. So that may be somebody's baseline because they're just on a meeting or because of the topic being discussed. So if it's going all the time, I wouldn't pay a lot of attention to it. But if it's not happening at all, and now you're mentioning timing for your project, and all of a sudden I start doing this, now that could mean that, you know what, something's causing me a little bit of discomfort about what you're saying about the timing. So I would then wrap up my sentence and ask a question. You know, we have some flexibility on the timing here, George. How did what I suggested match up with what you were thinking? See, I would add that so that now you have a chance to say, actually, Melinda, I was hoping we could do that in a little shorter time frame than what you just mentioned. So now I have a chance to overcome the objection, or I have a chance to say, you know, George, we can't do this and here's why. But if we cut out this part of the project, then I can get you something in the first 2 weeks. You know, it gives me a chance to address any issues while I'm still in the room, whether that's the Zoom room or the conference room.
And Melinda, it just dawned on me that we often think about the body language of the speaker, but you're talking about the speaker noticing the body language of the listeners and correcting and responding to that in a corrective way.
Yeah. And so, you know, your show is your intended message, right? So a piece of this is your body language. There are things you can do for people to feel that you are, as we talked about, more confident, that you are more engaged, more passionate, more intelligent, all of those kinds of things. But there's another piece of it, which is reading the response. Because if you go in and just say everything you wanted to say or you intended to say, that's not a successful meeting. A successful meeting is when you've said it, you've seen their response. They've responded in a way which leads you to either agreement or approval. That's a successful meeting. So if you leave out that whole piece of how they're responding, you're losing a lot of your ability to win decisions.
What does it mean when your listener or listeners are crossing their arms?
I'm so glad you mentioned that. That's another myth. So a lot of people think when somebody's here that that means they're being defensive or they're blocking you and things like that. This can mean that if, again, you and I are talking, I'm all here, and then you mention to me what you're charging for your service, and all of a sudden I come here. That's showing a little bit of discomfort. But if when we started and when I speak to groups, often everybody's here at first. Why? They're in a room with a bunch of other people. They're having a speaker come up. They're worried about, is this person going to be good or are they going to be boring? So a little bit of discomfort, we give ourselves a little self-hug, right? And we also protect. Remember, I talked about the unconscious wants to protect vulnerable areas. Well, the front of our bodies is very vulnerable. We have heart, we have stomach, all those things. So we feel a little more comfortable because we have a little hug and we're protecting those vulnerable areas. When people start here or this is just their default, this is their comfort here, I don't worry about it. Now, I really feel rewarded when I say something, I see them come unfolded.
Mm.
But I don't need to worry about them being here if that's their default. I will worry about it if I start seeing a real grab in the white of their knuckles because now I'm seeing stress. Okay. So usually it's just a default position to feel a little more comfortable. What's interesting is when they did studies of people in their home, when you're in your own home, you're rarely in this position. That's how we know it's a little bit of discomfort that this is making us feel a little more comfortable.
So if we're on a crowded elevator, crossing our arms like this is a normal response. Protect me from all these people around here.
Yeah. So your brain, your unconscious, your brain is always trying to go to comfort. So it does little things to make you feel more comfortable. And when I talk about this in my speeches, I speak internationally to sales groups and companies and executives and leadership. I have at every time when I cover that point, people come up afterwards saying, thank you so much. People always tell me that I'm being defensive, and it's really, I'm just more comfortable here.
Mm. And it could be that the room is cold, or I suppose you might even cross your arms if you're tired, feeling tired.
Yeah. There's a lot of reasons that do not relate to blocking or being defensive, but people have read that myth so much, they interpret any cross of an arm as that, and that's not right. I would say 90% of the time, it's just somebody giving themselves a little bit of feeling comfortable, whereas they don't feel comfortable, as you said, in a group or the meeting's about to start, but they do feel comfortable at home, which is why we don't see it so much.
Mm. What are some techniques that the speaker might use to demonstrate that they are confident, that they believe in this idea, they know it's going to succeed?
Okay. So a few things. One is, don't hide behind the podium. So I always request that I want a mic that's either one of those mics around the head or that I have a lavalier. Because when you come out, now you have the full body to be able to read, right? And people, whether they're trained or not, are unconsciously reading your body language. The first thing they notice, posture. What's the difference between how you feel about me when I'm here giving a point, when I'm here giving a point, right? So all the professionalism, your belief, your confidence, your leadership, you want to be tall, shoulders back and down. The other thing we talked about earlier, using your hands. You need to use your hands naturally when you're speaking. If you don't do that, then people on some level kind of get a feeling like maybe they're not that confident in what they're saying. I wonder why. Are they hiding something? Do they not know? What? You know, so things like that. So all of those things are good. The other thing is people don't think about it, but there is a body language to the voice.
Mm.
So my volume, if I'm here when I'm talking, then people don't really feel like I'm confident. If I'm here, they do. If my pitch is lower, they see me more as an authority. Also my pacing. You know, that's something, if I'm talking really fast like this and I'm giving you 100 points and you tune out. It's too fast. Why is she talking so fast? So you want to be able to have pacing where people can hear what you're saying and process it. So all of those are nonverbals for the presenter. And it's very helpful when people understand that.
You mentioned the word pacing. What about physically pacing at the front of the room or across the stage? Is that a good idea to demonstrate energy, or is it a negative?
Generally, it's a negative because it's very distracting. And people read it as that you're nervous. You know, you always see the pacing tiger in the zoo, right? So, you know, that is very distracting. The one place I see it almost as the norm is stand-up comedians. But generally, if you are a speaker, a professional speaker, as I am, it's okay to move and you want to move, but you want to move with intention and purpose, not randomly across the stage.
And we talked about natural movement. Are there gestures that a speaker might rehearse and use at an opportune point to emphasize a key message?
Well, I think it helps to rehearse so that you know what your path is. I think it's a mistake to memorize and then spit it out to everybody because it's a different intonation when somebody is memorizing something and saying it versus when they're saying it and just speaking to you. Right? So I feel practice is for that. You'll feel more confident. And when you feel more confident, you will naturally show the very confident gestures and nonverbal behavior. So I like to work with clients from the inside out by helping them have the confidence to know what to do. But I also work with them on, look, if you catch yourself doing something that shows low confidence, for example, clasping your hands and stuff while you're talking, yeah. Then I tell them to just slowly move out of that. Don't do a break because then what are you doing? You're calling everybody's attention to it. But if you notice that just the unconscious has gotten nervous, it's doing something, you're here, then you just slowly undo it and you keep talking. So the main thing is if you know your message and you feel good about it and confident about it, you will naturally show good nonverbals.
Your body language might speak to other people, send messages to other people. Can you harness your own body language to speak to your own self-conscious, especially when it comes with self-confidence?
Yes. It's interesting because there was some misinformation on that from a study that said that you actually change the stress hormones in your blood when you do big things and like that. But as I talk about in my book, someone did an audit of all the research that's been done. And what they found is even an open, neutral position like this helps with your confidence. So there is no necessarily changes that happen in your brain just by doing big. But when we are confident, we tend to be big. When we are being more aggressive, we tend to be big. So again, privately, I like to do very big things because nonverbals are a two-way street. They are communicating to others and they're communicating to your own brain. So I like doing very confident moves, and having good posture is one of those, when I'm just practicing privately or before I go on. And those things all help.
I'm curious, what other exercises do you do to get your body fully into the presentation before you speak?
Yeah. So one is I do voice, because one of the biggest things there is voice. And all of us have different pitches that we can speak in. When we're excited or frightened, we tend to be up here in the higher register, but we have a medium and then we have a low. So I always practice to keep in my low before I go out there on my low pitch. The other thing, and this is something that the Navy SEALs, I read about this, they use this in training too, is they found that when you talk to yourself in the third person, so Melinda, you've got this, and I'm patting myself on the shoulder, or this higher part of the arm are very, very good places to touch to give somebody support. And what they found is the brain doesn't care whether I'm giving the support to myself or whether you're giving it to me. It registers it in the same way. So before I go on, and by the way, the weeks before I'm doing something, like when I gave my TED talk, I told all of my network, whenever you see me, I want a pat on the shoulder or the back with a, you got this, Melinda. And then I also did that for myself. And I gave one of the best speeches I've ever gave, even though I was really a little nervous about it. So those are all things you can do to prepare and be best at your performance.
As we were getting close to wrapping up, Melinda, let's talk about, you mentioned your book briefly. The book is called Read the Zoom. And who's that for? What will they get from it?
So it's really written for people who are in the business community, or if you're in healthcare. And all the scenarios in there are about that. But what's great is it's a picture book. It's got over 100 full color pictures of expressions and body language. So anybody can pick that up and learn very quickly about how to read nonverbals. And then there's also a section on about lie detection. There's a section on how to make sure you're not making a false assumption, and how to set up your Zoom so that you're making the right impression if you are on a virtual meeting. The only place you can get it is on the site readthezoom.com. So if you're interested, take a look.
And you can find that link in the description below. That's for Read the Zoom. Melinda, you also invite people to reach out to you on LinkedIn, either to connect or follow you because of your regular tips that you provide.
Yeah. So I'm posting pretty regularly on Tuesday and Thursday mornings. And it's always tips on either body language or the psychology of persuasion, influence. Those are the topics that I work with executives on. And so that those are the things I write about and would love to get people's comments.
And you can find that link to Melinda's LinkedIn profile in the description below as well. Melinda, as we prepare to wrap up, if you could sit down with a team leader who is new to the position of team leader, and they need to and want to convey more confidence when they're speaking to the team, but at the same time also appear open and honest and inviting at the same time. If there's one, two, or three pieces of advice you would give that person, what might that be?
Well, I think some of what happens that could really help you happens before the meeting. So it's how you communicate that you're having the meeting. It is what you do on the agenda. It's that you open and close it. But I would also have them engage other people on the team to handle certain parts so that they feel a part of it and heard. And they act then as sort of facilitator. So in the nonverbals, again, you want to be there first. I think you want to establish where you want to sit to have the power in the room. And a lot of times that's not at the head of the table. A lot of leaders sit in the middle on the side, so they really have greater reach for who's looking at them and who they can see. And you establish the leadership and rapport there. The other piece is to make sure that ultimately you have the respect of everybody by, at the end of each thing, do what you're doing, George. You're doing a really great little short summary, and it gives you also a chance to congratulate somebody or to compliment someone on something, but also to talk about next steps. So that's what leaders do. And I actually get called in on a lot of engagements where someone's been promoted up to manager. And because they're now having to manage peers, that's a little more challenging. And I help them with that transition on little subtle factors that help them have greater influence.
Powerful advice. My guest today is Melinda Marcus, reminding you that it's okay to pat yourself on the back and saying, you're doing a good job, George. You're doing a good job. And I'm going to remember that one because I need more of that.
Well, before you close, you're doing a great job, George.
If you like what you heard, tell your friends and post your 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, because that helps more listeners find us. Come back every week for more practical insights to help you deliver your intended message. I'm your host, George Torok.